As Professor Juan Cole has written, Helena Caban is one of our great foreign affairs journalists. She has covered the Middle East, Africa, and elsewhere for many years and is herself an accomplished Arabist. Those interested in the Middle East or world affairs who are not reading her blog, Just World News, he writes, are depriving themselves of one of the more important sources of insight available on the Internet today. Coban has contributed a regular column to the Christian Science Monitor since 1990, covering such issues as strategic affairs, human rights, peace building, global governance, and international justice. She has authored or co-authored 7 books, including The Moral Architecture of World Peace, Nobel Laureates Discuss Our Global Future. She is currently Senior Global Affairs Fellow with the University of Virginia's Institute for Practical Ethics. I want to welcome Helena Caban to Takes on the World. Hello?
Hello?
Hello, Helena.
Yeah.
Welcome. I don't know if you heard what I just introduced.
No, I'm afraid I didn't.
Well, I just gave you a very glowing introduction, quoting Professor Juan Cole. On April 30th, there was a large protest in Washington and other locations around the country organized by a new Save Darfur coalition that is trying to portray that very genuine tragedy as a new Holocaust or genocide, according to the resident of the White House. From what you have written and from what other information I have read, this seems to be an oversimplification that may in fact hinder rather than help relieve that situation on the ground. Is that the way you see it?
Yes, that I certainly understand and deeply, you know, empathize with the wonderful goodwill of people who care deeply about this issue and care deeply about the suffering of so many of the people in Darfur. Darfur is a collection of 3 states within the system of Sudan, which is a sort of a federal system, but not federal enough. So there are 3 states in the east there where there, you know, has for some time now been a really serious armed conflict and armed uprising against the central government. And then the central government has used its own troops and also used sort of private militias to try to put down the uprising. And that has caused, the whole conflict has caused terrible suffering for the people of Darfur, and the suffering has been imposed by both sides, probably very strongly disproportionately by the government side because it is a government. But both sides have, you know, burned down villages, enacted terrible violence against the people in the villages and you know, ethnically cleansed areas where they wanted to. And, you know, I know because I have done a lot of research in a country like Mozambique, which was very similar when there was a civil war there, that it's very hard to just say that one side is wrong under those circumstances. But what has been happening in this country with the Save Darfur coalition is they have a statement that just, you know, blindly points the finger of blame at one side, at the central government and at its allies, who may describe sort of in a very simplistic way just as Arabs, and accuse them of committing genocide against people whom they describe just very simply as Africans. But, you know, as Emily Wax and other great reporters who have spent a lot of time in Darfur have pointed out, things are not nearly as simple as that. You know, in fact, the conflict is more like a traditional conflict, such as, you know, we've seen at a lesser level in this country, between people who are pastoralists and herders and people who are settled agriculturalists. And, you know, that's something that happens all around the world, and especially when people's livelihoods are in jeopardy. And you have to put this in the context of the enormous, you know, hunger and starvation and real problems of livelihoods that all these agricultural people in this portion of Africa, East Africa, have been facing. So, you know, when things get tough and you can no longer make a living as a pastoralist, you can no longer make a living as a cultivator, you know, that's the time when the young men get whipped up and involved in militias and conflicts and insurgencies and janjaweeds and all the rest of it. So from my perspective, the most important thing is to address the livelihoods issue, to get these people back onto their land and to ensure that their livelihood can, you know, actually be sustained over the years ahead. And that requires a lot of things. It requires a peace agreement, first and foremost, because without a peace agreement, people can never go back. Luckily, we have a peace agreement, you know, and the African Union has done a lot to negotiate that. And to its credit, the Bush administration has helped to negotiate that as well. So we had the peace agreement that was concluded just around the end of April. There are huge problems of implementation. But, you know, I think it's really a pity that very well-meaning people from outside kind of come in this country, and of course, you know, what the United States does is so influential around the world. Just with this one-sided picture, you know, blaming the Arab portion of the population, which is indistinguishable when you're there on the ground. Just about everybody speaks Arabic, and everybody looks very, you know, black-complected. So this distinction that, you know, the Save Darfur coalition makes between the Arabs and the Africans, it's not really a real distinction, and it misses a lot of what's going on, and it misses, crucially, the need to get a sustainable peace there.
Well, certainly the great majority of the people who have come out and are protesting are calling for something to be done to save the people of Darfur are well-meaning, but it certainly seems that the leadership of the organizations, many of them very connected with pro-Israel organizations, and in fact, are using that as a way to bash Arabs by trying to portray this as an Arab, Muslim Arab versus black, where everybody there, in fact, is black and also speaks Muslim or speaks Arabic.
And are Muslims. I mean, it's not like South Sudan, where the opposition movements are largely Christian and animist.
Right. And so this seems to be an exploitation of that, as well as to gain favor among the African-American communities and take take the world's eye and America's eye away from Americans.
Well, I think it's possible that some people have those kind of ulterior political motivations, Jeff, but I would say that most of the people, you know, most of the Jewish and other people who participated in the demonstration and, you know, in the various other actions are genuinely doing it because they think this is going to help.
No, I think I'm talking about the way this has come together. Even the Jerusalem Post reported that this was conceived by largely Jewish organizations. Obviously, it's a horrible human rights situation. But you point out another article that further south in the Congo, within the last several years, the numbers of dead there are estimated to be up to 4 million, and nobody talks about that issue at all, hardly.
Well, that's true. You know, that's also conflict-related deaths, and on a far, far larger scale. There, too, the situation is very complex. You might even say even more complex,
right,
because, you know, but people who like to do something, you know, in a simple way, pointing a finger of blame is a very, you know, simplistic and can be very compelling political action. I would say more than diverting the attention of Americans away from what's happening in the occupied territories, the small numbers of people, and I want to stress that, you know, I think most of the people in the Save Darfur Coalition have just excellent instincts, and I think it's great, but they, you know, just really need to learn a lot more about Darfur and about, you know, the realities of what happens when a society is plunged into civil war, you know, and how morally unclear everything really is in such circumstances. But for the small minority of people who are sort of like exploiting this movement, I would probably try to also divert people's attentions from what's happening in Iraq, which, yeah, of course, is where we have direct, absolutely direct American responsibility for the really atrocious deterioration of life that the Iraqi people have been suffering, and also from the preparations that some in the administration and some in Israel have been making to get us into a mindset to launch some kind of military action against Iran, you know, so that we'll all be so busy worrying about Sudan that we won't notice that they're going to go over and bomb Iran. And, you know, I think it's important that we actually seek to control what our government does as Americans than that we start, you know, gratuitously pointing fingers of blame at what, you know, a very poor and hard-pressed government in a distant place like Sudan is doing. You know, it is awful what has been happening there. You know, I don't want to diminish that for a moment, but the bad things that have been happening, you know, are a responsibility of many parties, not just the government. Although, of course, the government, being the government, has to take, you know, overall responsibility for the success of the peace agreement. But, you know, let us, as Americans, focus much more on the bad things our government is doing.
That would keep us very well occupied.
You know, and so I'm very concerned that that's the major sort of distraction part of this. There's a whole other issue that I'm sort of working on in my writing these days, and that is this question of elevating genocide or, you know, some genocides to a level of what Carla Del Ponte, who is the chief prosecutor for the Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia, has described to me as the crime of crimes. You know, actually, there are many other terrible crimes that cause just as much destruction of individual people and of whole communities, like crimes against humanity, that are just as bad as genocide, but somehow, you know, people sort of, many people have this idea that genocide is somehow worse than anything else. I think they are all truly atrocious. You know, whereas what's happening in Eastern Congo, for example, that you mentioned earlier, it's hard to say that that's genocide as such. But, you know, it's definitely crimes against humanity, and, you know, certainly more than 4 million people have died there over the past 6 or 7 years because of that. So, and, you know, from an American perspective, the destruction of the native people, so many native peoples on this continent, generally didn't have the degree of intentionality that is required for something to be classified as a genocide. Although, you know, there were some, I guess, over there in California, Northern California, you had a whole group called the Yuki Indians, who were the subject of a terrible genocide back in the 1850s. You know, and you even had the governor of California saying things like, you know, we have to exterminate these Indians. So that definitely makes it genocide. You know, but most Indian peoples were, their nations were destroyed, you know, in different ways over longer periods of time, through starvation, through the denial of livelihoods, and without that degree of direct intentionality that is required for genocide.
Well, it does. Actually, the word didn't even exist until the Holocaust and World War II.
That's right.
So then it becomes like a catchword, which is used to describe situations where it may not, in fact, be the situation, but the result of an internal conflict like we see going on right now in the Sudan. One of the things you pointed out in your writings, is that a side effect and a negative side effect of the protests here by Save Darfur is giving encouragement to some of the rebel militias not to agree to the peace agreement that was just a sign that came up in April, actually just signed in May.
Yeah,
two of the organizations, at least two of them, have not agreed, and they want a better deal from the government. And since that the rallies here are portraying only one side, as you mentioned, that seems to give them an impetus to hold back rather than join in this peace agreement, which may be the only solution to the situation.
Yeah, I guess I raised that in my blog. We should say
yes.
This is on my blog, justworldnews.org, which happens to be down right now, which is really annoying.
Oh.
I don't know why. But
right.
Anyway, people should take a note of the URL, justworldnews.org, and go check it out when it gets back up again. But I was raising a question more than asserting it as a statement of fact, but it seems fairly evident from the way, you know, what I know about the negotiating, that the at least two of the opposition groups did sort of take comfort, if you like, or strength, that, or some hope that they could get a better deal with American intervention, given, you know, the fact of this mobilization, this anti-Khartoum mobilization in this country. I actually think it's really significant and interesting that Bob Zelik, who is the State Department person who does a lot of this negotiating in Africa, and he has, you know, he's worked on the Darfur negotiations in the past. He went right over to Abuja, Nigeria, and joined in the negotiations right after the demonstration, that big demonstration, April 30th. And I think he did manage to get a slightly better deal for the rebel movements than what they had been getting before. But I think his presence there also, you know, should indicate to the rebel movements that, you know, they're not going to be able to budge the United States any further than this. That, you know, regardless of how big the mobilization is in this country, these are the terms of the deal that the United States, as well as the United Nations and the African Union and all the other parties, want to proceed with. I think everybody, you know, that's involved in the negotiations, and here, again, you know, I have to give some credit to the Bush administration for having gotten involved in this, you know, in the peacemaking. They recognize, I mean, if you're there, if you're Jan Egeland and you're trying to get humanitarian aid to these people, you know, the first thing is we got to get a peace agreement that will enable them to go back to their homes and try to rebuild their livelihoods. You know, keeping people in refugee camps is the most dehumanizing and dreadful circumstance for those individuals involved, but it's also, you know, politically incendiary, as we saw with the refugee camps after the genocide in Rwanda in 1994. The refugee camps, because the people in them have no livelihood, they have no, like, settled interest in the status quo, they become just real fodder for the insurrectionary movements. And indeed, many of the refugee camps and IDP camps, an IDP camp is what is established when refugees leave their home region and go elsewhere within their own country. And so that's when they're called an IDP camp. If they cross a national border, as some of them have, and go into Chad, then it becomes a refugee camp. But, you know, functionally, there's no difference. So people in the camps have been extremely angry, and of course they are, you know, they're feeling very insecure there in the camps, and I just hope that the African Union force can give them enough reassurance that there is hope, that there is, you know, hope of resuming their livelihoods, that they can hang on until the peace actually gets implemented. But of course, you know, many people have noted in recent days, first of all, that just the basic humanitarian aid has not been sufficient. You know, so all these people who are saying, save Darfur, save Darfur, it's not an abstract question. I mean, why is our government, why are the rich governments of the world not providing enough, you know, basic foodstuffs and safe drinking water and latrines and you know, just basic items to allow these people to stay alive? You know, that's what riles me, that people make these, like, huge political issues, but our government is not doing what it could do very easily. When I say, you know, I support Save Darfur, it's not an abstract thing. I want to save the people of Darfur and help those people, you know, not only to have enough wheat or whatever it is to eat today, but also to have decent livelihoods into the future. So I think that's where we need to put our energy.
Well, as you wrote him, as we heard last month, the New York Times reported that Sudan had just received a third of the $746 million it had requested from donor nations, and that resulted in the UN having to cut food rations in half from 2,100 calories a day, not very much, to 1,050 calories a day, half the level that's recommended. So we saw a situation where Darfur had actually slipped from the consciousness of not only from the governments, because they had pledged aid, which is easy to do, but they hadn't provided it. So perhaps there is an impetus now to get that aid to the people.
Gosh, I certainly hope so. And, you know, above that, we need to give enough support for the African Union people. I was just reading in the newspaper today there's, I think, 7,000 African Union peacekeepers.
Just a little over that, yes.
In an area the size of Texas. You know, I mean,
and they're not even allowed to participate in the fighting. They're more to monitor and peacekeep. And now we see they're going to be replaced, maybe as early as September, by a multi-nation UN force. And this is also raises some issues because UN forces behave differently in different areas, and certainly, like in Haiti today, in recent months. They have not behaved very well, and also there's been problems in the Congo. So we really don't know what that's going to mean, except it'll be a larger force to have, let's see, 7,300 people patrolling a country the size of Texas without the kind of highways and roads that seems an impossible situation.
Yeah, I think, you know, the African Union peacekeepers, I mean, it was a great idea, and it still is a great idea. One that the South African government, the Nigerian government, you know, of the really inspiring, well, I wouldn't say the Nigerian government is an inspiring government, but, you know, I mean, it is powerful. And they do have this powerful idea that, you know, it's really up to the African nations to try to help each other out of their problems and to help build peace and security in these, you know, very, very troubled regions. But they can't do it on their own. I mean, you know, even if they have large numbers of well-trained military people, which I doubt. You know, they need a lot of training. They need a lot of just basic payroll support for these peacekeepers. But above all, you know, they need a huge amount of logistics support in terms of, you know, radios that are interoperable, helicopters, off-road vehicles. You know, actually help building roads so they can get around some. And, you know, that will also be a lasting legacy for the people of Darfur if we actually had some, you know, engineering brigades go in and build roads and bridges and, you know, sort of little health clinics and schools and such. It, you know, it just burns me up that we have been pouring money into this war and totally failed occupation in Iraq. You know, how many billions of dollars is it now? I guess it's like $400 billion or something.
At least.
You know, if we took like 1% of that and put it into serious, you know, people, community-focused aid to sub-Saharan Africa, we could have prevented so many of these problems because, you know, going back to what I said earlier, at root they are problems of, you know, an intense crisis of livelihood that people in those parts of the world, many countries in Africa just cannot, you know, sustain a decent livelihood, and that leads to desperation, it's to radicalism, it leads to violence, you know, both violence between communities, violence inside families, and it's, you know, we know enough here in the rich West. You know, we can't say we don't know this stuff. That you have to have peace, you have to have, you know, people talking to each other, you have to have investment in the infrastructure, all the things that we've had in this country, you know, as we've built all this stuff in this country. And African people are no different. You can't expect them to, you know, to live on nothing. You can't expect them to be, you know, peaceable and good-natured and sweet to each other if they are just, you know, eaten up inside with worry over the future.
And actually, the Sudan is just one region, and not just the Congo as well, but one of a number of regions in Africa in which the situation, because of drought, because of the fact that they do have minerals that are very valuable that other people want and the people don't benefit from, makes them attractive for plunder and for warlords taking advantage of, either doing their own or working for some foreign country. And so if you look at the continent, since the Treaty of 1880, where the colonial powers divided up Africa, it has not been a pretty picture.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's hard to say what you can do to correct that map. It was 1885, the Treaty of Berlin, and the European powers just sat around and drew lines on maps and divided up the whole continent between them and established these lines. So Sudan, in a sense, I think it's the second largest country in Africa. And Congo is the first largest, and, you know, you note that both of them are, you know, just plagued with internal instability, failure of governance. I mean, probably from a rational point of view, both countries are far too large to be governed effectively. And so you need to have, you know, a radical form of devolution of power to the state level. And, you know, that's actually part of what's happening with the Darfur, the peace agreement that they have been negotiating, that there will be more power for these three states in Darfur. Sudan also has, you know, the ongoing and fairly challenged peace in the south, and then potentially it has a lot of issues in the east. I mean, it is an enormous country. I've never had the chance to get there. My ex-husband's family had some land and some interest there, and just, you know, hearing their tales about it, it was a sort of creation of the British, if you like, right there at the head of the Nile and in the heart of Africa, and also with a coastline onto the Red Sea.
Many of our problems are with the creation of the British. later they will say, if our race survives, many of our problems are the creation of the kids, as they will say. What is the U.S. interest beyond the humanitarian interest in Darfur? U.S.-Sudanese relations have been kind of tricky. The Sudan is on the U.S. government's terror list, but the U.S. also works with them in this so-called war on terror.
I don't know the exact status of the relationship right now. You know, as you said, they are both on the terrorism list and supposedly providing some services, and they did. I mean, actually, earlier in the late 1990s, they sort of put Osama bin Laden out, and, you know, where previously he had been using Khartoum, the national capital there, as a base. They exiled him, and that was when he went to Afghanistan. And I think that was in response to U.S. urgings and U.S. Relationships with intelligence people there in Sudan. It's a strange old world, really. I mean, it's very similar to their relationship with Syria, where Syria is also on the terrorism list, but at the same time has been providing some very interesting services to the Bush administration, both regarding the so-called global war on terror, where they have a common interest, and also regarding the safety of the long border that Iraq has with Syria. So, you know, I wish I could say I trust my government here in the United States to be doing the best thing for everybody concerned, but I don't at this point, and I'm sure they have all kinds of really nefarious relationships with different shadowy groups inside Sudan and beyond. I mean, you know, we read today, and, you know, the European press has been full of this for quite a while now, that the U.S. has been assembling something in Somalia over there in East Africa that is sort of called Warlords Against Terror. I mean, you work with the warlords against people who are accused of being al-Qaeda. I mean, it just strikes me as a recipe for future, you know, for prolonged militarization of these societies, you know, pumping U.S. weapons into these societies and ensuring that what would otherwise be local conflicts actually develop a level of lethality and damage that will make it very hard for the societies to recover from them.
Well, I know there is a reticence after the U.S. experience in Somalia to send U.S. troops into that region, but there will be, obviously, the U.S. will help to finance the U.N. troops. We have a call here on the line. Hello, you're on the air. Hello?
Hello.
You're on the air.
Thank you. I've been following your program with interest, although I missed the very first part of it. It seems like you've hit on something in terms of the languaging. I mean, the fight against terrorism, I mean, that sounds very reasonable all the time, but also, so it seems like it's a justification for kind of a terrorist occupation force in other areas. And the word occupation just doesn't seem to convey what it actually is. You know, it's like having somebody living in your house with a gun to your head all the time and watching your every move and telling you what you can and cannot do at any time. So it seems like there needs to be some other languaging of what an occupation actually is and what that does and what that means. And so it's language in a way that makes it as abhorrent as it actually is for the people that have to suffer under it. And if you want to follow that discussion, I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you, caller.
Hi, yes, that is an interesting issue. I mean, the languaging issues are certainly important. And, you know, we also discussed a little earlier, maybe you weren't there, you know, the use of the term genocide as a sort of similar mobilizing tool that sometimes doesn't exactly tell you what's going on. You know, so it's always good to fight against genocide, but nobody's so clear about crimes against humanity, which, you know, as we had pointed out, are often just as damaging or even more damaging than genocide. Now, regarding occupation, you're quite right that the simple term occupation doesn't quite, you know, convey the horror of what it is to live under foreign military rule. I'm kind of split on this issue. You know, I followed the Israeli-Palestinian issue for a long time, and I can certainly tell you I was in Gaza and in Ramallah and in many of the occupied Palestinian areas just a couple of months ago. And, you know, it's extremely humiliating and debilitating in the West Bank when you have to go through all these checkpoints just to get from one, you know, one part of town to another, one city to another. And, you know, an 18-year-old Israeli soldier can say, no, you can't go, and, you know, can force you to get all your bags out of the car, and you have to go back where you came from. And, you know, that kind of situation prolonged now for, nearly 40 years in the West Bank has generated a huge amount of anger and, you know, just wrecked the economy of that area. And the same has been happening in Iraq. Of course, the occupation has also done worse things, I would say, in Iraq, the U.S. occupation, because it now turns out, been, you know, arming all kinds of sort of effectively private militias through these, you know, mercenary private security contractors, and just been, once again, pumping arms into the community there, so, and one group off against another, and kind of igniting a civil war. So, and the insecurity situation in Baghdad and in large parts of Iraq is just horrendous. The reason I'm kind of torn on the issue of occupation is that my dad was in the British military occupation of Germany after the Second World War. And, you know, I think military occupation, that is, you know, occupation of one country by the military of another country, is always, you know, it cannot be democratic ipso facto. But, you know, if there was such a thing as an occupation that helped a society to recover and rebuild, that one did, and the American military occupation of Japan, you know, but that took enormous wisdom on behalf of, at the time, you know, President Truman and Secretary of War Stimson and others. And they used that wisdom, they had that wisdom, because they saw what had happened, you know, after World War I, where the punitive approach that the Allies adopted toward Germany had incubated Hitlerism. You know, so they really saw you need to rebuild the society in a sensible way. Of course, they didn't have any such plan, or rather, you know, where the State Department did have such a plan in Iraq, Rumsfeld just came in and tore it up and said, no, we don't need to do that. So, yeah, you're right. Occupation doesn't quite capture what it is to be ruled by a foreign military organization.
Well, actually, it's true. There's a difference between the occupations of Germany and Japan at the end of World War II were not belligerent occupations. You did not have the occupied populace at war with the occupiers, but the war was still going on. In fact, the war was over, and now you see a country that is being dismembered, Iraq being dismembered by the U.S. invasion, and even talk about it in the newspapers. Senator Joe Biden, and Leslie Gelb of the Council of Foreign Relations saying maybe it would be better if we break up Iraq into three religious states, which is actually a plan devised by an Israeli political official back in the 80s to break up Iraq and divide into confessional states. It's interesting, the caller talked about someone moving into your house. You probably saw it, in, like in the West Bank, I've seen in Gaza, where the Israeli soldiers actually take over somebody's house and use it as a lookout point, a base, and confine the people to the cellar or the first floor. They can't even go in upstairs in their own home. So that actually does happen. In Darfur, you have you've had these situations, though, where even the rebel forces have interfered with the food aid coming in, have kidnapped African Union soldiers, and so we have a much more complicated situation, which isn't being reported here. You did mention in an article of yours on April 26th that you were happy to see the Security Council recognize that atrocities were being committed by both sides in this war.
Yeah, and unfortunately that's what usually happens in war. So, you know, to me the big lesson is you need to find a way out of the conflict situations and find a way for people to live together in, you know, in a respectful and democratic and nonviolent way.
Do you think that the UN coming in September or before that or after that with a force of maybe of 14,000, 15,000 can actually rectify this? Is there something in that peace agreement that you've been able to see so far that offers the people of Darfur enough so they'll be so those militias that are not supporting the agreement would not get support from within the refugee camps?
Well, I think that does depend on implementation. From my perspective, I don't think it makes much difference whether the force is at an African Union peacekeeping force or a United Nations peacekeeping force. So long as it is much more capable than the force that is the peacekeeping force that there is there now. And, you know, if they could beef up the AU force, that would be great, and that might be more acceptable to the local people, I don't know. The UN force, I guess one of the big issues is that would have to be negotiated at a higher level with the Sudan government, with the national government, whereas you already have the AU force in there, and the AU force could be empowered more easily, maybe, than, you know, setting up a whole new UN force. But it's not just getting the peacekeepers, it's getting the, you know, reconstruction projects. The UN is very good at a lot of these things, and we have to recognize that there have been many situations where the UN has actually not only done good peace building. What I call peace building is what happens after you have the formal peace. You know, peacemaking is like negotiating the peace, and then peace building is when you actually take that piece of paper and you turn it into reality on the ground. The UN is also really good at, let's say a lot better than the U.S. government, at sort of keeping an archive of the lessons learned and how you would do this. Like, they could take, you know, things that they have done in Cambodia or in Mozambique and, you know, just sort of recreate those structures. And one of the main things they focus on is what they call in their jargon DDR, which is demobilization, demilitarization, and reintegration of former combatants. Recognizing that you need to get the former combatants from both sides, or all sides in this case in Darfur, you need to get them reintegrated back into civilian life, and have a very intentional plan for doing that. In Mozambique, which I have just been studying for my book that's about to come out now, when they made a peace in the civil conflict there in 1992, the UN actually did this DDR program.
Helena, I really hate to stop you there, because we come to the end of the hour. That book on Mozambique will be coming out. I look forward to that. Your URL is what?
JustWorldNews.org.
I recommend all of you listeners to look up that. Who are online to look that up. My guest has been Helena Coban for the last 45 minutes. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Yeah, thanks for your listening.
Thanks on the world. Bye-bye.
Bye.